From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Our program this week asks if the college and university business officers gathered in Seattle recently saw a preview of Bill Gates on Higher Education version 2.0. We will also discuss the outsourcing of adjunct hiring at some community colleges in Michigan. Hi, this is Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note that you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our conversation today talking about Bill Gates and the business officers, his conversation in Seattle this week. Joining us are Zakiya Smith, a strategy director at the Lumina Foundation. John Warner, a visiting faculty member at the College of Charleston, is also the editor-at-large for McSweeney's Internet Tendency and the just visiting blogger at Inside Higher Ed. And Doug Letterman is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome. So by way of background, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has spent, and foundation officials might say invested, some $500 million on higher education in recent years, supporting various efforts intended to, quote, ensure that all students who seek the opportunity are able to complete a high-quality, affordable, post-secondary education that leads to a sustaining career, end quote. Mr. Gates has been a strong advocate for data, analytics, metrics, and the use of technology in higher education to enhance instruction and to improve institutional outcomes. Not surprisingly, Mr. Gates and his money have excited some and annoyed others in and beyond the higher education community. In a public conversation in Seattle this past week at the annual NACUBO meeting, that's the National Association of College and University Business Officers, Mr. Gates seemed to present what some observers call the more nuanced vision and better informed approach to higher education reform. While retaining his strong advocacy for data, metrics, and analytics, Mr. Gates acknowledged that graduation rates and starting salaries are not necessarily useful metrics for looking at institutional outcomes. And while he believes that technology can significantly enhance the instructional and learning experience, Mr. Gates told the NACUBO audience that MOOCs, massively open online courses, will not be a major catalyst for change in higher ed, are effective only for the most motivated students, and that much of the current MOOC content is mediocre. Doug Letterman, you were in the audience when Gates spoke at NACUBO, and it was, in fact, your headline that suggested it was a more nuanced Bill Gates. What do we need to know about his conversation in Seattle this past week?
Well, by more nuanced, we meant to compare what he said and how he said it to the rhetoric we've previously heard from him and others like him. And by that, I mean what we at Inside Higher Ed somewhat snarkily call the disruption crowd, the collection of think tank types and commentators, policymakers, and funders who believe that traditional higher education is underperforming, if not fundamentally broken. Gates is not the most outspoken of those people. In fact, part of the reason we wrote about this speech is because he speaks relatively rarely about higher education in such an extended way, but he's certainly among the most influential of them, given the money that you referred to that he injects into the enterprise through his foundation. Plenty of what Gates said during his speech would have made his critics' heads explode. He dissed faculty unions. He predicted that there would be many bankruptcies and mergers of colleges in the next 10 to 15 years, and he praised the work of for-profit colleges on student retention and said that they shouldn't be regulated differently from other colleges. Those are just to name a few. But he also, to my ear, made it clear that he's been listening to his critics, or at least paying maybe more attention than he had previously to what's going on around him. He acknowledged that much of today's online content was middling at best and that much of it was crummy, his word, and that MOOCs weren't going to contribute very much to improving higher ed. He made the point that overemphasis on a small number of oversimplified outcomes in higher education could have bad results, including implicit criticism of the completion agenda that he and his foundation have helped to push, and the impact that too much focus on sort of getting students through could have on low-income students. And he talked about growth in the number, in the quote, number of professionals who aren't involved in classes on university payroll. So he sort of, it was a nod to the criticism that faculty members say about the growth in administrators. So I guess what I saw was some walking back from some of the overreaching claims that the disruption crowd tends to make, either about how flawed higher ed is or about how rapidly and effectively some reform or another is going to solve the problem. Those are almost always exaggerated, those claims, and they don't serve the cause very well. And I guess I saw in Gates some moderation of that. Now, not everybody agreed. One of our commenters said, beware lowering the guard from he who suddenly professes some of your beliefs, the better to turn you inside out after all. Another commenter said 100 years ago, Andrew Carnegie got the same amount of attention when he invented TIAA, we would be foolish if we didn't pay very close attention to Mr. Gates and what he thinks. So that just gives you a little context into why we wrote about it and why we thought it was noteworthy.
Sakia, big message with big money. The Gates Foundation and others, and some might say Lumen is included in this, have been accused by many of essentially engaged in, or described by many as being engaged in entrepreneurial philanthropy, articulate a big message, use big money, make big investments, and seek a big return on the investment. Is that a fair way to summarize the strategy of sort of the new foundations that have emerged over the last decade?
Well, I think a way that we've categorized it at Lumina is the leadership model of philanthropy. Our president, Jamie Marisotis, is pretty unapologetic about the fact that those with resources in foundations can take risks and try to tackle challenges that other people maybe haven't wanted to tackle or haven't been able to tackle. And that's something that we should use to our advantage and not be ashamed about doing that. So I think it's a fair assessment, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that foundations want to be more directed about exactly what it is that they're trying to solve.
Okay. And John Ward, you've written about these issues from a kind, what I would characterize as kind of a high-touch perspective in some pieces at Inside Higher Ed recently. Critics argue that Gates and others, Doug characterizes them as the disruption crowd, don't get the high-touch aspect of the college experience, and that a lot of the initiatives that are being supported, that are being funded, that are being promoted, in fact, miss that high-touch experience, which is so important for the very populations that the new philanthropists say is the one that they care most about, and that is students who come from low-income, disadvantaged backgrounds who are first-generation college attenders. Is that a fair critique?
I think so. I think there's very, very little existing evidence that technology is something that's going to bridge these gaps that we all agree exist, or that there is some sort of magic bullet of massive open online courses that will suddenly unlock the potential of all these people. And I think the reason is because Bill Gates, I think, has a mistaken notion, or a limited notion, maybe more accurately, of how learning happens. He seems to equate education with the delivery of material and information, or expositing, as Larry Summers put it at an Aspen Institute talk, Summers being another one of the disruptionists.
Larry Summers is the former president of Harvard.
Former president of Harvard and Treasury Secretary. And the reality, I think, of teaching, and my perspective comes from being in the classroom teacher for the last 15 years, is that we're human beings and everybody learns a little bit different. And the notion that we can make something personalized that doesn't involve people just seems like a kind of utopian folly to me, and those hundreds of millions and billions of dollars people like Gates are putting into education would be much better served going to people who are educators rather than technology to replace them.
Doug, let me use a bad technology metaphor to pick up on your more nuanced Gates headline in your reporting from Seattle. I mean, just as DOS, operating system for personal computers, went through lots of iterations, could what we saw and what you described in Seattle be the sort of Bill Gates 2.0, in one sense, a refined, more nuanced kind of stuff in terms of tailoring his message, softening his message, improving the message? Or alternatively, if he's not getting that message across well, as you suggested for many groups, what does he need to do better?
Well, listen, I think he is, like I said, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear John and Zakiya whether they saw anything different in Gates' comments than I did. I, again, sitting there, I thought there was some moderation. I think they're listening. I think they're, I think they've started changing a little bit there, the way they make grants and the way they look at it. There's a new head of the Gates, sort of post-secondary arm about 18 months ago, came out of higher education, Dan Greenstein. So I think there's some adjustment here, and I think they are acting a little bit less than they were a couple of years ago. And again, that's what we were trying to do, is be comparative, that they have all the answers. I think they're still outsized influence and arguably undeserved influence in some ways. But I think there is some moderation here and a little bit of I think the 2.0 model is not a bad one. I think there's some change and some movement in that direction.
John and Zakiya, let me come back to another issue where the conversation about Gates and technology and what Doug refers to as the new disruptors harkens back to conversations we had in higher education some decades ago with the rapid expansion of higher education. During the 60s and 1970s, there was a conversation, obviously not fueled by technology, about the difference between mass and elite higher education. With the rapid expansion of community colleges, the dramatic growth of public four-year institutions. John, you alluded to some of this, I think, in your close to the reading list for Bill Gates that was part of your blog this week, referencing the mission statement of the Lakeside School, which is where Bill Gates went to high school when he was in Seattle, and where at least one of his children attended, which is very much high touch. And the question is, does elite versus mass leave high touch for the elite and high tech or low touch for the mass?
I think there's no doubt that these trends create a greater divide between the types of education that the elite and the masses have access to. People like Bill Gates and even President Obama send their kids to schools that are not subject to the sorts of policies they would like everybody else to operate under. And there's very little reason why a community college should be asked to use technology and replace people, when really there we have a student body that would benefit from high touch far more than any other group, a group that needs as much guidance and mentoring as possible. So the notion that, as has been tried, where a community college, or what they tried at San Jose State, where they adopt a MOOC curriculum that is supplemented by professors, just seems like foolishness to me. It seems like madness. A true putting the technology cart before the human horse, if you want to hear a metaphor. This may be a Gates 2.0. I would say more like a 1.5. I think he's bumping up against reality. I think it's happened in his K-12 education policies, where he's actually seeing what happens when classroom teachers look at some of the things in Common Core and the testing that's going to go along with it and saying, hey, this doesn't make sense. He's a smart man. I think he's hearing similar things, and maybe he's evolving because of it.
Zakiya, so much of the conversation that Gates, Lumina, and others are trying to foster is about improved outcomes and how you measure those outcomes. I guess it's fair to throw the question back to the foundations as well, and in one sense ask this of you, and that is, how do we measure the outcomes of these investments? I mean, Gates is involved in many things. Certainly, they have a broad healthcare initiative. Much easier to measure the return on that investment in terms of the eradication of malaria, reduced rates of HIV, or improved rates of child mortality. What are the outcomes that might be appropriate in terms of looking at the Gates or the Lumina or other investments in education? What's the time frame? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years? Is it 20 years?
Well, you've asked me kind of the perfect question, because Lumina's mission is a very clear outcome with a very clear timeline, which is that by 2025, 60% of adults have high-quality post-secondary credentials. So clearly we're part of the college completion outcome camp, and the outcome that you would measure, and I think most folks that are part of this camp are looking at annual completion numbers. Lumina funds an annual report that we put out about, you know, how the nation is doing in reaching those completion targets, state by state, even in some cases county by county. And there's criticism of that approach, obviously, which is why we're really careful to think about quality. And that's one of the new areas that has some controversy over how you would measure high quality. But we are pretty convinced, and again, unashamedly so, that we need more people with post-secondary degrees and credentials. And you can argue about that, but that's something that we think is a good thing to measure as it relates to our investments making a difference.
Great. This conversation could go on. Unfortunately, we don't have time to do so. My thanks to Zakiya Smith from the Lumina Foundation, John Warner College of Charleston, and Doug Letterman for a very animated and energetic conversation about Bill Gates and the business officers. Thank you. Our conversation continues as we talk about the outsourcing of part-time faculty hiring at community colleges in Michigan. Joining us are Gary Rhodes, professor of education and the director of the Center for Study for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. And staying with us is Doug Letterman, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. And again, by way of background, on Monday, July 21st, Inside Higher Ed reported that a group of community colleges in Michigan have outsourced the recruitment and hiring of adjunct faculty. These are faculty who make up the overwhelming majority of the teaching force at these institutions to an educational staffing company. And just last week, a faculty union at a sixth institution in Michigan, Jackson College, signed a collective bargaining agreement allowing EduStaff, that's the outsourcing company, to take over adjunct hiring and payroll duties. The revelation about outsourcing adjuncts in Michigan was a catalyst for a large number of comments, many negative, some also reflecting anger, if not outrage. Yet early reports suggest that the outsourcing arrangements at the Michigan community colleges have generated significant savings for the institution, largely because of the reduced cost of employee benefits, may put a little extra money in the paychecks of the adjuncts, again because of reduced cost of benefits, may allow adjuncts to be eligible for certain kind of benefits they might not get if they were part-time employees of the institutions, and provide other kinds of potential benefits. However, the impact on instructional quality was not clear, as the question about instructional impacts was either not asked of the campus officials interviewed for the article, or none of the interviewed officials were prepared to offer comments about instructional quality and related issues. So, Gary Roach, you study these issues. You're a scholar of the professoriate. You've also done a stint as an executive officer of AAUP. My guess is a little bit of anger and outrage at the notion of outsourcing adjunct hiring?
Not so much anger and outrage, but actually the same question that you featured and started with, as well as a financial question. The first question really is about the quality of education. What's the impact on the quality of education that students are receiving? And let's just think about this company and the company that one of those Michigan colleges, Kirtland College, thought about doing a similar arrangement with about 5 years ago. Both those companies are known for primarily their business model is working with substitute teachers in public schools and providing substitute teachers for districts. If you go to their websites, that's what you see, districts, subs. I don't know that substitute teaching and the way that we staff substitute teaching is renowned for being a contributor to the increased quality of public education. And I do know that in higher education, whether you're on the management side of the world or on the labor side of the world or the scholarly side of the world, as I am, we know that engagement matters. Engagement between students and faculty and between faculty and their peers in serving students. And we know it particularly matters for the sorts of students that these colleges, community colleges, are serving. First generation, first in their family to go to college. So the question is, how does abdicating responsibility for training those faculty members, for recruiting and selecting those faculty members, how does that increase the engagement between the institution, the faculty member, and the student? And so I think that's a major problem with this sort of arrangement. I wouldn't call it a movement, since it's a handful of institutions which seem to be searching for ways of saving a few thousand dollars. Or a few hundred thousand dollars. There's the financial question, just very briefly. If you go to the website of North Central Michigan, they have a very healthy financial statement. Over the past 5 years, they've had substantial increases in assets and reserves. They say they're going to be saving or have saved a few hundred thousand dollars. I would want to know, are they putting that back into the support of education, to the support of faculty members and the education of students?
Fair questions. Let's take some of these questions apart. So, Doug, to some of the points that Gary raised, first on the hiring, at least the article in Inside Higher Ed states pretty clearly that what EduStaff is doing is largely vetting. It's not doing hiring. It's handling some of the paperwork. It's handling some of the HR policies. But ultimately, the hiring decisions are made by the individual institutions. It's not a matter of sending somebody to show up in a classroom, but it's more a matter, it sounds, from my reading of the article, that here's a list of people, of potential candidates and potentially a wider pool of candidates than you might get on your own who are available to teach the widgets course or the calculus course or whatever the course might be. Is that a fair place to begin?
Well, I think it's a little, from my sense of it, from what was in the story and talking to our reporter, there's a bit of variation in how the institutions are using this company, and so I think in some cases it's still in process, it's sort of to be figured out about sort of how they're going to use them. But yes, everything I can tell, they're not going to be sort of outsourcing the decisions. And I think the really important thing about this, this is very limited. This, as Gary said, it's just a handful of institutions. It's some of the reasons institutions are doing this in Michigan is because of this sort of odd benefits law that they have, and this is kind of a workaround. The institutions are able to there's sort of tax benefits to doing it this way. So I tend to agree. I totally agree with Gary that this is not a movement and not something that's likely to be replicated. But there are a few sort of more important things. One is this is a real. I think part of the reason there was such pushback and reaction is that I think it was very sort of insulting to a lot of the adjuncts at a time when I think they're feeling insult from a lot of different directions and sort of from a purely sort of just how it looks. It just looks bad and feels bad to them. I think the really important thing here, and I imagine Gary would have some things to say about this too, we have a broken system in general of an increasingly dysfunctional system of employing the academic workforce, and this is just, I think, just sort of one symptom of that, and I think it's a particularly sort of stark one, and again one that I think is unlikely to be replicated. But I think the really important thing going forward is for greater national conversation about how to employ and compensate the people who do instruction in ways that best serve students.
Well, Gary, let's talk about some of those points. I mean, one of the key issues is if, and I think most would agree that the system is broken. There is, if you will, a surplus of talent searching for academic opportunities. Institutions, particularly public institutions and community colleges, have undertaken a major transition from full-time to a lot of part-time employment for positions that could, in theory, could easily be full-time in terms of the number of courses and the topics that are being taught. These are not obscure, but fairly general areas. And yet, you know, does this kind of model provide a wider pool for the institutions? At the same time, given the issue of low pay and bad benefits for part-timers, EduStaff says that, in fact, because they are the hiring agency and not Acme Community College, they're able to provide some benefits for folks who actually become their employees that these folks might not get as part-timers at a public community college.
Yeah, I'd really be more convinced by data. And again, I'd say, well, they do this with substitute teachers. Have we seen a significant increase in the working conditions of substitute teachers in Michigan as a result of their work? I'm really skeptical about that. I think Doug's point about how people are hired and then how they're compensated and also how they're integrated into the institution, what sort of access do they have to institutional resources, are all things that research has demonstrated. Adriana Kizar writes about this, who has the Delphi project at USC. I've done a survey on this with the new faculty majority entitled Professor Staff, where we found one of the challenges in hiring faculty is they are not integrated into the institution until the very last minute. And that means they don't have access to resources about the class and neither do students. So I see nothing in this process that deals with that problem, which, as Doug rightly said, and you as well, Casey, is broken. Instead, what I see is a further distancing of the engagement of the institution with the people who really, frankly, are their employees. If you're doing 60% of the work of the institution, it's sort of a shell game to say these people are not our employees. I'd be much more convinced, too, that this is going to benefit the adjunct faculty members if there was some upfront commitment to their per class salary is going to increase. They're going to get some benefits. I'd like to see that in writing, not just hear that it's going to happen. And I'd like to see that some of the savings that are cited as being realized by the institution are channeled back into education. Each of these institutions, interestingly, I think, is in a really different situation. The latest one, Jackson, is in a much more metropolitan area in southern Michigan. There you could make a case, I think, that you need, you have this huge pool, and maybe there's some variation in that pool, but maybe you should just be coordinating with other colleges. If you're in upstate Michigan, it isn't a real surprise who's going to be available to teach. If you're in a rural area of upstate Michigan, whether it's North Central or the other one, Kirtland, the people who are teaching for you are the same people who've been teaching for you for years and years and years. They're teaching composition. They're teaching remedial math. It's no surprise. And so I think this is really about marginal monies. And I'd really like to see the institutions, if they're saving monies, come forward with reinvesting those monies in education and in their faculty and in the quality of students' education.
Doug, as an observer, what do you see to say to that?
Well, I think what I see in this story and in many of the others on our site of late, we had the story this week about the unionization campaign for adjuncts in sort of running into some speed bumps in Minneapolis. Sort of this effort by SEIU and others to get a bunch of institutions in a particular city to unionize the adjuncts there, sort of to create these regional hubs. I think we're seeing, and I just came from we talked about in the last segment, Bill Gates' speech at the business officers meeting. At the business officers meeting, I just came from lots of discussion about how to improve the efficacy and the efficiency of providing instruction. And I think this is kind of a ham-handed example, but I think we're seeing lots of experimentation, lots of searching around the country for figuring out ways to do this better. And Gary obviously has lots of ideas about how that might be done. I'm hoping for, and again, I don't think this Michigan effort is going to rise to the top of the list or of possible solutions to the set of questions about how we compensate and provide academic instruction going forward. But I do think people are looking for models, and I think these institutions, like others, are sort of searching for ways to do it. Again, I'm not endorsing it in any way, but I think that's what sort of explains, at least partially explains, why it's happening, and I think it explains a lot of the activity that we're going to be seeing over the next year to 5 years over how to make this broken system better.
Well, Gary, so let me come back to you. You're a scholar of higher education. You're a researcher. You've talked a bit about you'd like to see the hard financial numbers in terms of true savings as opposed to just sort of moving money from one pot to the next. What would be some of the other metrics that you would look for that would convince you to say maybe this works, or alternatively sends up a red flag to say, no, this is not working at all in terms of the issues you've identified as being key: engagement, quality of instruction, and related topics?
I think there's several metrics. One very simple one is in the financial statements. Instead of just hearing that the college has saved $250,000, has the college reinvested that money in its students and faculty? That's a very simple thing to track. And I think it wouldn't be hard to see in the financial statements from year to year, has the percentage of institutional revenues spent on instruction increased or decreased? And we've seen for 20 years a decrease in the investment in instruction. For a variety of reasons, one of them is the increased hiring of adjunct faculty, not providing them with reasonable salaries or livable salaries and benefits. But that's one very easy metric. Another metric is you can very easily determine what the hiring process is like for an institution by doing an online survey of your faculty. And if you're a faculty unit, if you're an institution, you should be interested in, are your people being hired last minute? And has this new model decreased that and increased the sort of ability of the people in the hiring pool to prepare for their classes or not? because that's part of what's broken, that people are hired last minute and that they don't have access to instructional resources before they even start teaching. Has this changed that or not? And then I think the third metric, and Doug referred to it quite clearly, look, Michigan is a state that has been looking for ways to undermine the ability of faculty to collectively bargain. And if you take off the table the idea that these are your employees, then you won't be subject to a union drive. And although there has been a little hiccup in Minnesota, even more recently, Inside Higher Ed just published that in Bill Gates's hometown of Seattle, there's yet another private university where adjunct faculty have overwhelmingly voted to support a union drive and to have a union and have that union be the SEIU local. So I think this is also quite a conscious way of saying, just like with graduate employees, and universities are doing this now, University of Michigan's done it recently with research assistants. They're not our employees, they're the employees of a foundation or of a third-party provider. It's a way of preventing employees who nationally are beginning to organize more and more, in this case adjunct faculty, from organizing at your institution. And so it's driven not by educational interests, but by financial and power interests.
All right, and that's a story we're going to have to continue to watch to see if it does move from Michigan to other areas, and to also to continue to ask Inside Higher Ed to watch the quality aspects, Gary, that you alluded to as well. My thanks to you both, Gary Rhodes, who is a professor of education and the director of the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona, and, of course, to Doug Letterman, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you both.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And that's the program for this week. Our thanks to Gary Rhodes of the University of Arizona, Zakiya Smith from the Lumina Foundation, John Warner from the College of Charleston, and of course Doug Letterman from Inside Higher Ed for joining the discussion this week. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio streamer podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about this week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.